Judge J.P. as in Paul Coleman, Ackerman, Mississippi, March 30th, 1974.
Former governor of Mississippi, now member of Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
I didn't tell you the book is scheduled for publication on Sunday, March
30th. Not for attribution without permission.
Whig candidate in 1861, where South Carolina had voted unanimously for the ordinance of secession, the delegates in Mississippi, there were 26 opposed, although they ultimately signed it, all except two. Mississippi had a very, very strong populist movement in the 1890s. They were never able to elect any state or national officers, but they elected many, many on the local level, legislators. For example, this county, the populist, took over the courthouse almost and did send a representative to the legislature. Senator Gore of Oklahoma, later of Oklahoma, was then living in the adjoining county of Webster and was a very strong candidate for the legislature on the populist ticket, although he got beat. In 1932, 1936, 1940, and 1944, of course, the National Democratic ticket in this state was untouchable. Mississippi had its would-be revolt. Some of the men named as presidential elector by the State Democratic Convention in 1944 announced they were not going to vote for Roosevelt and Truman, whereupon Governor Bailey convened a special session of the legislature and amended the election laws and put out a slate of presidential electors for Roosevelt and Truman, nominated by the legislature, which I was one. I was then only 30 years old, but and we overwhelmingly carried the state. In 1948, I was a state circuit judge, so I did not participate in that business, but we turned right around in 1952 when Governor White was the governor and I was the attorney general and carried the state against General Eisenhower. In 1956, when I was governor, we carried by an even larger majority for Stevenson. Then in 1960, by an 8,000 vote margin, they went for the Byrd electors. And the National Democratic ticket has not carried Mississippi since 1956. So we've had a history of alternating lights and shadows, I'd say. And that which has happened in the last 25 years, in many respects, is a product of what went on in the years before. Tradition doesn't die very easily in Mississippi. I think there's an explanation for that. Up until recent years, when we came to be heavily industrialized, the population went from grandfather to son to grandson and on down the line, and chiefly in the same areas. My father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather, all three died at the same house. We've been living on the same farm down here since 1835, although, and before that, of course, we were in South Carolina for about 60 years, so, and that's largely true of this area. It was settled chiefly by people from the Carolinas and Georgia. I must say that in the overall context, by far the most tremendous change has occurred since 1948. With that statement, I think I'll leave it open to questions, specifically.
What is the most specific change that occurred during that period in state politics?
Well, you gentlemen have no doubt made a considerable study in Mississippi, and you know what's been going on. For example, in 1951, Governor White was elected governor of the state on a platform really of not rocking the boat and of pursuing our advantages and minimizing the race question and so forth and so on. He won by only, I believe, 8,000 votes. I came along on generally the same approach in 1956 and was elected by 46,000 votes, carried 66 out of the 82 counties. Defeated the man who had been governor and two men who later were to be governor, Ross Barnett and Paul Johnson. Of course, in 1959, Barnett got elected governor on the argument that we had been weak-kneed and vacillating and milquetoast and on the question of Southern rights and states' rights and race question and everything else. He defeated Lieutenant Governor Carroll Garton, who I think could have won easily if he'd have made a more two-fisted campaign. That's not said in any way to deprecate him, because he was an unusually fine man and certainly a most satisfactory Lieutenant Governor. In 1963, I was defeated in the runoff for governor because I had campaigned actively and strenuously for Kennedy and Johnson in 1960. And of course, the Oxford episode had intervened in 1962, which pretty well reflects what was going on in Mississippi in that year without my elaborating upon it. However, Johnson, once he was elected, pursued, I thought, a very satisfactory policy in general. He certainly didn't go about inflaming the populace or making empty threats or insupportable boasts. Of course, John Bell Williams elected in 1968 over William Winter, who was considered, quotes, the more reasonable man, unquote, but he himself did very little, I thought, to exacerbate the situation. Waller, since he was elected in 1971, has pursued, I think, a very acceptable policy. He has not been a race baiter, and he has not been one to defy the United States government. And things are certainly far quieter and more tranquil in Mississippi now, and have been for several years, than ever before. We have a good many federal lawsuits, but we don't begin to have the things that went on, such as in the Philadelphia episode. I've forgotten right now what year that was, when the three men were killed and buried under the dam, and other such incidents. I think the most complete change has been the now really unquestioned admission of the black people to the ballot, which certainly did not exist prior to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, plus their participation without any intimidation or trouble in the electoral process and their election to many local offices, plus the fact that in most places, nearly all, the integration of the public schools has been brought about with a minimum of trouble. There's been a great deal of disruption in the educational process in a few places, and the public school system has been abandoned in a few counties because the people all fled to the private schools. But I would say that Mississippi is an altogether different place today than what it was in 1948. I suppose it has some distance to travel, but it'd be my considered opinion that it has traveled most of it. It's made most of the way.
What do you think would have to happen for Mississippi to go Democratic again in the presidential election?
I think the people of Mississippi have been very, very unhappy outside the Democratic Party since they quit going Democrat. I think the sole explanation has been that they thought that the party was nominating wholly unacceptable men as a general proposition. Of course, some of it has taken place under the impact of recently more or less inflammatory events, but I think the proof of it all is that they're going right on sticking with the Democratic nominees as a general rule in all state and local elections. I don't know how many Republican members we have in the legislature, but not many.
Four.
That's out of a total of 120 in the House and 52 in the Senate, so that's four out of 172 then. We have elected a Republican congressman from the Meridian District in the Goldwater landslide of 1964, and they elected two this last year, one from Jackson and one from Pascagoula. My own analysis of it is that the young man from Pascagoula, Lott, was elected in spite of the fact he was a Republican, but on account of the fact that he's a very personable, very able young man with a lot of promise, and he'd worked for Congressman Coleman. He knew where all the votes were and how to get them. That's a very heavy Democratic area down there on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, highly organized labor union, and so forth and so on. I think that the young man in Jackson, who happens to be the son-in-law of one of my close personal friends, former Democratic National Committeeman from Mississippi, Hugh Clayton, got elected probably because Senator Bodron and Representative Brown had been in a total bloodletting primary, and obviously Brown's people just voted for Thad Cochran in the general election. I would say that Mississippi is still basically Democratic, and of course, obviously, when you throw a delegation out, as they did in Miami in 1972, you're not going to carry the state, and it's futile to attempt it. I believe that Mississippi would get back in the Democratic Party pronto if, for example, they could get the law passed, which I think they've been trying to pass in the legislature. I don't know whether they've passed it or not, of allowing the delegates to the national conventions to be elected by the people just like other people are, and just as they do in Alabama, and eliminating this argument about racial discrimination. They claim, you know, we still adhere to the old precinct, county, state convention method of selecting delegates to the national conventions. But I think it's as much a question of the National Democratic Party taking Mississippi back as it is Mississippi taking the party back. They are obviously Democratic in belief and in principle and in background. And 1964, they went for Goldwater. In 1968 and 72 for Nixon, I believe in 1972, they went more overwhelmingly maybe for Nixon than any other state in the union percentage-wise. But most of that, well, you remember they had a row at the convention in 68, too, in which they, maybe in 64, in which they just seated the really pretenders, people who had no political influence in the state and were not going to have any. Of course, we had that in 1952. I was at the Democratic National Convention in 1952. And a bunch of people went up and contested us at that time. And I was not a delegate to that convention by choice. I didn't really want to be a delegate, but I wound up acting as a spokesman for the so-called regulars. And they were seated by an overwhelming majority, and we carried the state, even with Keith Arvo on the ticket, who was highly unpopular in Mississippi individually. I remember they had a rally in Knoxville, Tennessee in the fall of 72, and Governor White and I went up there, and Keith Arvo said, I think if you people in Mississippi knew me better, you wouldn't hate me so badly. I said, Senator, they don't hate you. They just disagree with some of your political beliefs, your governmental principles. And hatred or not, I think that if that's what it is, you may need more of it because you're going to carry Mississippi, and he did. But he and Stevenson and Keith Arvo together did. But it's been the product of political maneuver and political grabbing for individual power, rather than a disagreement on the basic principles, I think, of the two parties or the identity of the two parties. I remember in 1952, our challenge was led by a man who had run for governor the year before and who got 8,000 votes. Governor White had walked out in 48. Of course, I know personally from knowing him and talking to him that a lot of those who walked out in 1948 did it. They were opposed to it. They didn't want to do it, but the majority voted to do it. So when Governor White ran, he was selected for his second term in 51. Well, he put up the big posters, I walked out in 1948 and I will walk out again if it's necessary. So they accused him in the 52 convention of being the walking delegate. They said that they were just up there as observers, that they'd stay as long as things suited them, and when it displeased them, they would leave. And I remember in my argument to the Credentials Committee, I said, well, maybe Governor White is the walking delegate or the walking candidate. But my good friend over here, and he was my good personal friend, is really the walking candidate because he ran for governor last year, and out of about 500,000 votes, he got 8,000. Now, if you think you can build any strength at Mississippi on seating people with no more clout than that, well, that's your prerogative. They didn't do it. The so-called National Democrats in Mississippi now are led by a man by the name of Aaron Henry and a lady in Jackson, whom I don't know. I believe her husband is a professor maybe at the University Medical School. Mrs. Maybe y'all can supply me.
Pat Darien.
Yeah, Mrs. Darien. Well, Henry never overlooks an opportunity to say things that are not about to be accepted in Mississippi. And the result is that they don't have any real base of popular support. Now, I don't know if they were to start electing the delegates. It might be that that a lot of people who otherwise are in position to influence many, many votes wouldn't bother to run for delegate, but I think it would be worth trying because we're not going to get anywhere in Mississippi operating as we've been for the last 12 years, that's for sure. I think a strong governor could change it, but I mean, a governor with strong convictions in that area, but none of them have really seen fit to make the effort. Waller made an effort to get Mississippi seized in 72, but as I recall, he didn't go himself and turn his influence in on it or enlist the aid of governors of other states, Democratic governors. I'm not saying he should have. I'm just pointing out that he didn't. That was a decision for him to make, and I have a very stern policy of not publicly criticizing my successors. That's the most obnoxious thing I suppose an ex-governor can do, is sit around and second-guess his successors. There's nothing any more ex than an ex-governor, you know, when it comes to those things.
Is it hard to refrain from it?
Not really, once you assume the role. I mean, if I, of course, I didn't refrain until I put on that black robe. I mean, I very actively participated, but once you're a federal judge, you got to decide whether or not you want to pay the price, and if you do, well, all right, and if so, do it, you know.
How do you assess the administrations during that period? And where you place yours and how you see it and so on?
Well, I suppose that my chief pride in my administration from 1956 to 1960, with the Little Rock crisis right on top of us across the river and other things, my chief pride in it is that we had no difficulties or problems in Mississippi of any consequence. The idea of hating someone because of the color in which God made him and that sort of thing was totally, almost, not totally, but substantially submerged, very much more so than at any prior time. My administration was the first one in the history of the state to guarantee a 9-month school term on state funds for every child in the state, regardless of his race. We maintained very happy relationships with the other states of the Union and the other governors. On the other hand, I think the occurrences since that time had better speak for themselves rather than for me to evaluate them. They're there.
How do you explain the number of successes Republicans had last year in electing mayors?
Well, I think in municipal elections, people vote for the identity of the individual, what they know about him and what they consider his capabilities and so forth are, rather than what party he belongs to. Mm-hmm. I think every Republican could have as easily been elected if he'd been running on a Democrat ticket, and probably more so.
Do you feel that the conflict between the Loyalists and the Regulars will be resolved before the 1976 convention?
No, unless it's left to a vote of the people to select the delegates then. Let the people set it. They're not going to set it. It's a question of who's going to be the deacons in the church. It may be an empty post, but still it's a matter of pride with them. And that's true on both sides, I must say. Now, in 1968, Governor Williams could have avoided the contest in Chicago if he had agreed to allow 3 more Negro delegates, although they had not been chosen by the ordinary lawful process of convention, county, and state. Had I been he, I would have made the concession. I hope that's not understood as criticizing him, and that's one thing that I don't care to be quoted on, as I've already indicated. He took the position that that would, of course, undermine the methods by which the people chose their delegates, but the other side of it remains that you have a slate of delegates elected by the state convention itself. And they're generally named by the governor, at least in all my experiences they were, I started going to those conventions in 1940. I was a delegate from Mississippi to the Chicago Convention of 1940, which nominated Roosevelt for his third term and Wallace for vice president. So I've had some familiarity with the doggone thing. I think you have to make compromises. If you want to call them compromises. Some things called compromises are not really compromises. They're just concessions to the realities without being harmful to anybody, really. But as long as we follow this method of letting whoever wants to go to the precinct convention just go there and name the delegates to the county convention and let the delegates in turn name delegates to the state convention. And as long as it's a question, as I say, of who's going to be the altar boy, why, they're not going to agree. It's just the same kind of a spirit that has prevailed in so many other things.
Is there anybody in the state that could bring it together?
Oh, yes, there are people in the state who could bring it together if they were willing to exert the effort, but my guess is that most of them think that the accomplishment is not worth the time and the effort and the sacrifice because it couldn't be done by waving any magic wand. I thought for a while they were maybe going to settle it in 1972. There was considerable maneuver back and forth. But I think that Waller agreed, as I recall it, to have the loyalists hold half the seats to the convention, but then they wanted to guarantee that he would then appoint one of them to each of the election commissions in the state or some other utterly unacceptable premise. The governor can't bargain his appointing power away like that. He'd, I think, be violating his oath of office to agree that I'm going to name a certain number of a certain group to every election commission in the state, not because they're better qualified or more represented, but just because I have to do it to get my feet into a national convention. Had I been Waller, I would not have agreed to that. Of course, I would have tried to have forestalled the necessity of being in such agreement by some other more acceptable method, I think. Maybe it couldn't be done. I think both sides probably went so far out on a limb until there wasn't any way for them to get back.
What effect do you think Watergate's going to have on the Republican Party in Mississippi?
I don't think any.
If the Republicans run a full slate in 1975 for statewide offices of strong candidates, including some possible former Democrats, do you see a realignment possibly taking place and a lot of Democrats shifting over to the Republican Party?
I don't think so.
How about if you elect a Republican governor?
Well, that'll be the day when they do that. I don't think that's anywhere in the cards at all. And I'll give you some examples now of what went on in Mississippi. In 1968, we had several legislators, like the lady in Jackson, who was a state senator, who, under the impulse of the moment, although having been elected as Democrats, switched to the Republican Party and declared themselves to be Republicans, ally Strom Thurmond, what have you. And every last one of them were defeated in the 71 elections. So, I don't see anything in Mississippi today, economically, politically, or otherwise, that's going to help the Republican Party exercise any real influence at the state or local level. There'll be instances where a man, and we've had them, and we're going to continue to have them, where a man who is considered to be the better man, running on a Republican ticket for mayor of Ackerman or what have you, will win. But it won't be because he's running on a Republican ticket. Now, Reuben Phillips has made two races for governor on a Republican ticket in Mississippi, against Johnson in 1963 and against Williams in 1967. He carried this county in 1963, but it's because the people were sore because Johnson had defeated me in the primary. I supported Johnson. I'd run as a Democrat. I'd run for the Democratic nomination, and having lost, I voted for the nominee in the general election and made no bones about saying so, but the people said, well, you probably have to do that, but we don't have to. We're going to vote as we please. And Phillips is a consummate politician. Used to be a way-out so-called Truman liberal. Maybe that had something to do with his ineffectiveness. He was not ineffective, but with his ability to win as a Republican. I don't know. Politics, you know, as I've said about Mississippi, has some quick, sudden, unexpected volcanoes and eruptions, but I don't believe that'll happen. I'd have to see a whole lot more than I can see today. I don't know of anybody the Republicans have got who could be elected governor, even against weak opposition. You can't beat somebody with nobody. You've got to have a horse that's capable of winning the race before you can expect to win, and they don't have it. Carmichael is a very personable fellow, obviously well-informed, makes a tremendous appearance on TV, but he's never held any political office of any kind by which the people can judge him as a performer rather than as a candidate. I suppose he's the most able man they have at this time. You put it right down to the brass tacks, and I don't know whether he has any idea to run for governor or not. Maybe he has, maybe he expects to make another try for the Senate. But assessing the cold realities, I don't think he would make anything like the race today that he made back then. Of course, he complained about not getting the support of the national administration. And more or less attributed his defeat to that, but I don't think that was it. Senator Eastland and I have never been on the same side politically in Mississippi. We've always had, in my political lifetime, we've always had two factions within the Democratic Party. I belong to the Fielding Wright, Hugh White, J.P. Coleman crowd, and Senator Eastland, of course, has always been associated with the Paul B. Johnson